This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll discuss a survey that shows that women lose ambition for higher level positions, those management jobs, after just a few years on a job, and maybe how companies can change that.
First, there's news expected about Pluto next month as the New Horizons mission from NASA makes a close flyby study of the dwarf planet.
We'll get a preview of this new look at the former planet and talk about some other headlines in the science world, including the treatment of autoimmune diseases with parasites, and how self-domestication might be the reason for our species' success.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now. She does every month to talk about science news. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, and a very happy Monday to you.
Back at you. Well, let's start with this big news about Pluto. What's going on next month?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so just about on or about July 14th, the New Horizons spacecraft is going to whiz past Pluto and do a flyby that is going to be really exciting for a number of reasons. Now, to back up a little bit, yes, Pluto was demoted. It's not a real planet anymore, whatever. But in a way, because it was kind of kicked off the planet pedestal, we're actually learning a lot more fascinating stuff about it, and New Horizons is going to kind of maybe hopefully confirm some of the theories we have about it and also give us never-before-seen glimpses of the planet itself. Now, Pluto is part of the Kuiper Belt. That's this vast area beyond our solar system. It's kind of considered the third zone of our solar system, and it's full of really fascinating stuff and countless objects zipping around there. And Pluto is kind of considered the ambassador of the Kuiper Belt. So it's kind of our gateway drug into the Kuiper Belt, if you will, where astronomers are expecting to find really incredible, fascinating things.
Yeah, the Kuiper Belt, and I had to look up the pronunciation because it looks like Cooper or Kuiper Belt, but Kuiper Belt. What all is out there? How much stuff is out there in that distant zone of our solar system?
I cannot tell you how much stuff is out there because they don't even know. There's seriously countless items.
Maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe more?
Maybe more. There's everything from, you know, tiny rocks, asteroids, comets, other dwarf planets, crazy moons of Pluto that do nutty things. We're just really at the tip of the iceberg figuring out what's in the Kuiper Belt. But Pluto is certainly one of the most intriguing objects out there and one of the largest.
Why is NASA so interested in Pluto now that it's been demoted? What changed?
Well, there are a lot of reasons to be interested in Pluto. And, you know, one of them is Pluto may have some really important clues about the earliest days of our solar system. There's a theory that Jupiter was kind of moving around closer to the sun, further out, whatever. And then when it really started going further out from the sun and ended up in its current location, it kind of shoved everything out of its way and shoved Pluto and other objects out into the Kuiper Belt. And they think that because of that, Pluto and some other Kuiper Belt objects may actually preserve some really important information that will help us better understand how our solar system formed.
So this is maybe some data left over from billions of years ago when our solar system was kind of shuffling into place?
Yeah. It was kind of, you know, like, I don't know, like a pinball machine. And this could have a lot of the clues for us to better understand it. And Pluto in and of itself is really fascinating. You know, it's got this crazy atmosphere that's estimated at 350 times the volume of Pluto itself. And, you know, they also think we have, like, really kind of hazy imagery at this point of Pluto. New Horizons is going to give us much better images of the planet. And we think it may have really exciting terrain, like, you know, actual huge mountains and deep valleys and stuff, just by the kind of fuzzy little shadows that we can see in the imagery we have. So I think it's always super exciting when we get to learn about, you know, those corners of our solar system that we really haven't been able to study close up. So I'm expecting great things.
Well, we're going to be talking even more about Pluto on the 15th of July, so we can take stock a little bit later again, take a look at Pluto. We're going to move on now and talk about how people with autoimmune disorders are treating themselves with parasites, and in particular, what are they called? Hookworms.
Hookworms.
That's
voluntarily,
right. I should know that from its close-up of its little face
right.
with its fangs. Hookworms. Why would someone want to do that, Gemma?
Well, I have to start this by saying caveat, you know, don't just try this at home and go like sticking parasites on yourself. But, you know, there have been some studies, and actually one of the participants of a study in England had such great results when they infected him with parasites that he went off on his own and started a little DIY. And he's really the character that we follow in this story, because he had suffered for years from extreme food and environmental allergies, Crohn's disease, other really, you know, kind of life quality affecting issues. So he got infected with hookworms, and all of a sudden he got better. He was able to eat foods he hadn't been eating for years, etc. So when the study was over, and you know, the hookworms, they don't live forever, so you got to keep resupplying yourself, he found a way to resupply himself, and now he's just this leading advocate of, you know, if you have certain autoimmune problems, try a hookworm.
And the way this works, if I'm reading this right, it's hookworms have this evolutionary stealth. They're like, I'm going to parasite on you, human, but I've evolved the ability to reduce the inflammation that happens when I do it. And then that translates over to maybe reducing other kinds of inflammation at the same time.
Exactly, exactly. Basically, what's happened is, you know, a really good parasite knows how to live and thrive in its host without killing its host. So that's why they think hookworms have evolved, you know, millions of years aside hominids like us, and figured out a way. The technical stuff is basically they inhibit a certain kind of T cell, and that particular kind of T cell triggers inflammation. So by the worms inhibiting it, that seems to reduce inflammation across the board. So it's really fascinating stuff. And in addition to people ordering hookworm larvae off the internet and putting it on their arms so the worms can burrow in. I will leave you with that mental image for a moment. Let's pause. But in addition to folks kind of taking the DIY approach, there are actually a lot of researchers looking into this in a much more, you know, clinically controlled environment, and possibly developing drugs off their skills, off those hookworms' mad skills.
Right, so eventually it won't have to be you get hookworms, they burrow into your arm painfully. Sounds like researchers are working on pills from hookworm excretions, for instance.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, you know, I don't think it's painful as much as itchy. That's how the guy describes it. But I really don't want to spend too much time thinking about what it feels like for larvae to burrow into my arm, I got to say.
Okay, we'll move on then. We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, checking out some of the most intriguing stories from the science world. Now, humans, right, we've domesticated a lot of species, dogs, cats, you name it. Turns out maybe we domesticated ourselves, and that's why we can live with each other mostly without beating each other up all the time. Maybe?
Yes, yes. And, you know, the funny thing, if you spend a lot of time on, say, I don't know, comment threads on online stories or on Facebook, you might think we do not get along. But the truth of the matter is, when you compare us to our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees, well, let me put it this way. One of the researchers in the story says, you know, every day millions of Americans go to the movie theater, and we sit in a movie theater full of strangers, and at the end of the movie, no one is dead or impregnated. And if you had chimps watching a movie, that would not happen. There would be bloodshed. There would be all kinds of issues. So he really thinks, and he's one of a number of researchers, who thinks the key to our success as humans has been self-domestication over millions of years. That has enabled us to share information, build more elaborate tools, more elaborate settlements, cities, civilizations, and so on. So it's really kind of fascinating, and it's especially interesting how they're finding evidence of that in the fossil record.
So how would a species domesticate itself? I think of it as needing an outside agent.
Well, actually, self-domestication, and another good example is the bonobo. That is another very close relative of ours. And bonobos, they think, kind of self-domesticated themselves. And basically what happens is the individuals select for, say, a less aggressive mate. Maybe and I'm way oversimplifying this, I want to make sure that's clear, but maybe, you know, instead of going for the really big burly guy who beats other people up to win a mating contest, maybe you go for the guy who's just really good with kids. You know, that's like a gross oversimplification, but it's basically about selecting who gets to reproduce, and then those traits are passed on. And sure, it can happen, you know, within a species. We don't need an outside agent.
So this would be an evolutionary pressure rewarding cooperation over conflict, at least in some cases, that over millions maybe of years would add up into being able to live in a city with millions of other humans.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, one of the ways they see in the fossil record is if you go back more than 4 million years ago to Ardipithecus ramidus, and that's going way back in the fossil record, but you see something interesting. That is the first hominid that has reduced canines, you know, those big old kind of fangs on your teeth, and that's really unusual for a primate. If you look around, most primates have really large canines, especially the males, because those are used in, you know, kind of fighting another male for the right to mate. And they're starting to see the reduced canines 4.4 million years ago in our ancestors, making them think that, yes, over time, very slowly, you're starting to select for less competitive, more collaborative behavior.
So, Gemma, before we let you go, how unusual is this notion of self-domestication among human ancestors?
Well, you know, it's certainly a theory that's out there, and I think you would find that most researchers agree that we have done something in our lineage that has allowed us to be far more collaborative and really, you know, more like curious about strangers rather than just, stranger, kill him. So there is definitely something. I think there's a big range of opinion exactly when it happened in the fossil record. I think most people will agree it took millions of years to happen. But, you know, I think just looking around, just, you know, the fact that the technology we're using right now just to talk over the phone, elaborate stuff like that would not have evolved and developed if we hadn't evolved to be domesticated.
Well, Gemma, thanks a lot for talking. It's been great as always.
Always fun with you guys. Thank you so much.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about the latest science headlines.